It's Monday, the 28th of October, and this is the Monocle Minute. Today, China's Communist Party assembles for one of the country's biggest displays of patriotism. The former diplomat, John Everard, will explain why the world will be watching.
As the economy slows, as people find that they're not quite getting as much money, more money each year as they had the year before, they're starting to question party legitimacy, and the party needs to devise answers.
Also ahead, why mainstream media companies are operating on the dark web. And calls for a Media Freedom Act in Australia intensify after a united protest by the country's newspapers. I'm Ben Rylan in London. The Monocle Minute starts now. Over 200 key figures of the Chinese Communist Party are convening today for the start of a four-day event aimed at upholding and improving the socialist system with Chinese characteristics, which is a patriotic sentiment to those at home, but for those abroad, a tactic of intimidation. John Everard is a former British diplomat.
It means that this, the fourth plenum of the 19th Congress of the party, is going to be devoted to what the Chinese like to call organisational issues. They are going to try to raise the level of the party, raise its stature, try to do something about the damage that its image has suffered after a whole string of really horribly embarrassing corruption scandals. And it's quite probable, too, though we're not yet certain, that they will do something to further enhance the personal position of President Xi Jinping. In a sense, we are still living with the aftershocks of the political earthquake of spring 2018, when, you'll remember, we had two plenums back-to-back. The second and the third took place within a few weeks of each other, deliberately so that the Communist Party could get everything in place before the National People's Congress that year, which took place in March. This has had various strange effects. Firstly, it's meant that this plenum, the one that's starting on Monday, has had the longest gap since the last plenum of any plenum anywhere in Chinese history, which has caused a certain amount of excitement. It's probably due to the fact that they had two plenums together, but it's a footnote in history. The second thing is that normally the fourth plenum of any Congress is the one devoted to economic matters. It's a kind of historical nod to the fourth plenum in 1978, which is when Deng Xiaoping launched China's economic reform program, and it's been a kind of tradition ever since. This time, we're not doing that. We are doing, as I say, organisational matters, which I think is a sign of just how worried the party is about the challenges it faces, including all the things I mentioned, plus, of course, Hong Kong and a slowing economy. Consolidating his personal position and consolidating the position of the party as a whole. Lots of stage whispers that he has come under fierce political attack, not least from the political allies of the many, many people who he has purged, nominally for corruption, perhaps for other reasons too. The party position, as I said, has suffered after a lot of corruption scandals. At this plenum, we are expecting two members of the Central Committee to be replaced, one because he jumped from a very high window and isn't around anymore, the other because he was found to be corrupt. So corruption has sort of eaten into the plenum agenda already. It's a big issue in China, and as the economy slows, as people find that they're not quite getting as much money, more money each year as they had the year before, they're starting to question party legitimacy, and the party needs to devise answers. Nobody really knows. The Chinese position is clear. They've set it out in laborious detail on several occasions. They're not going to budge on any of the key issues, they say, effectively. The big doubt, of course, is in the White House. What is President Trump's master plan? The kind of pencil deal that we had a couple of weeks ago, is that going to be inked? What is that actually going to mean in practice? So really, a lot of question marks there, which nobody is well placed to answer. On the economy more broadly, it doesn't look as if the big economic challenges are going to be addressed at this plenum. I suspect they will have to wait for next autumn 2020, to hear what the Communist Party plans to do about them, which is quite a long time away, and things are not going to get better in the meantime. I think the Chinese would argue that a lot of Russia's push is smoke and mirrors. Russia doesn't have a great deal to offer Africa. What Africa wants is investment capital, and lots of it. And Russia's broke. Russia can't do it. China can and is. A Belt and Road Initiative, central now to Chinese foreign policy, and probably not going to be reviewed at this plenum because it's being reviewed internally. It's now been going for a while, and the Chinese have started to discover that some of the things that all these unpleasant Westerners were telling them about aid projects in Africa were in fact true, that if you just give African governments a lot of money, it tends to vanish without anything getting built, that if you put in purely Chinese work teams in to build bridges, stadia, whatever it might be in African countries tend to chafe because they want jobs for their own people, and so on and so forth. There's a lot that the Chinese are learning about the outside world that is being digested and is probably going to mean not exactly a relaunch, but a mild reformulation of Belt and Road, probably early next year. And in the teeth of fierce US resistance, and with the United States, for technical as well as political reasons, has been lobbying everybody they can find to go slow on Huawei. And they have produced, apparently, quite solid intelligence to show that the threat of Huawei can be used to penetrate information infrastructures is very real. Boris Johnson hasn't explained how he has responded to this American lobbying, whether he's taken account of it or anything like that. It's a simple a blanket declaration that, yes, we go ahead. I think that as time passes and as China continues not to intervene, so the prospects of a heavy Chinese intervention start to recede. If China were going to intervene, they'd have probably done so by now. And we know that Hong Kong is a furiously debated issue within the Chinese leadership. One of the big calculations, of course, is that if you intervene in Hong Kong, effectively you've ripped up the joint declaration with the UK. And if you rip up a solemn agreement of that kind, it means that no Taiwanese government is ever going to sign a treaty with you, that you've thrown away the chances of peaceful reunification of the motherland, that the only way you'd ever going to get Taiwan back would be to use military force. Effectively, that would mean that Xi Jinping goes down in Chinese history as the president who lost Taiwan, and I don't think he wants to do that. This could go badly wrong. It's one of those flashpoints that sort of simmers in the background and is probably not analysed anything like enough. If heaven forfend, it ever came to a military clash between China and Taiwan, it would reverberate politically across China. This is Chinese shooting Chinese, and that would look very, very bad. At a time when the Communist Party is feeling just a little bit nervous for other good reasons, it would think twice, I think, before letting that on. I suspect that a lot of LGBT Chinese look on it with enormous envy and just hope for the day when, who knows, there might be a gay pride march in the streets of Shanghai. The Chinese government tends to consist of elderly men of a conservative mindset who probably are harumphing in disgust at this moral libertinage.
At the end of last week, the BBC announced the launch of a new online service hosted on the Tor network, which also happens to be a portal to the disreputable dark web. Monocle's Augustin Macellari has the story. Org, for the unenlightened among us, what is the Tor network?
So the Tor stands for the Onion Router, which is an acronym designed to conjure this idea of layers. Essentially, Tor is a browsing service and web hoster that facilitates high levels of anonymity by streaming each user's application for data through a variety of different nodes, which are computers scattered all over the world run by volunteers. It was designed by the US Army, I think the military, and the idea was that people would be able to send highly encrypted messages and also to safeguard their own identities. Tor is both a browsing service and also a host, so it can be used to host hidden sites that are suffixed with .onion, which may be familiar to our listeners from the fairly recent furore around the Silk Road, which was this dark web drugs marketplace where people were trading in all sorts of things from heroin to firearms. And that's more or less, in a nutshell, what the Tor service is.
I mean, it's quite intriguing, and one expects that this is really where a lot of the darker undercurrents of the internet really live, and it could be a fairly frightening place and where all sorts of things take place that most of us who visit the normal internet would have no idea about. The flip side to this story, of course, is that the BBC is launching a new online service that's hosted on Tor. it does appear to be a case of strange bedfellows. Walk us back a little bit. Why is the BBC doing this? And, I mean, more to the point, why would any mainstream media organisation want anything to do with Tor?
Well, as you say, the dark web is this kind of shady place. I think it's a useful way of looking at it as analogous to the internet in the early 90s, when it was this kind of frontier. There were all of these tech utopians dreaming big dreams about what this kind of ease of information sharing could mean for societies. Also quite a radical place in certain fringes. Obviously now the kind of FANG, as they call it, the big five tech giants, have pretty well colonised the internet. Facebook, for many people, is the internet. So the dark web is not just where unseemly and shady things happen. You know, it's also a place that journalists go to find data that might be sensitive or to communicate information that they don't want to have picked back up. The BBC is making use of it because in certain countries, China, Iran, the BBC website is censored, which means that the citizens of those countries can't access it and can't get what is supposed to be, and I think historically has successfully been, a very impartial and fairly balanced source of news.
Augustin Magellari, it is an intriguing story. Thank you for explaining it for us. Australia's media is growing increasingly concerned over the nation's restrictive secrecy laws and their effect on media freedom. And there are now growing calls for a new bill to protect journalists and their rights. Karen Middleton is the chief political correspondent for the Saturday Paper in Canberra.
It's not what you'd normally expect to see in a free and fully functioning democracy. The front page of every major daily newspaper blacked out with redactions. But all of Australia's major dailies published censored front pages on the same day last week to kick off a national campaign for greater media freedom and to make a collective and forceful point that the way their government is enacting and interpreting laws obstructs public access to information. In a highly competitive market, the Australian Right to Know campaign has united arch rivals. Commercial media, including News Corp, Guardian Australia, and the former Fairfax, now Nine media conglomerate, have joined forces with the main public broadcaster, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and against Prime Minister Scott Morrison's Conservative coalition. The group is demanding the reform of defamation and freedom of information laws, better protection from prosecution for whistleblowers and journalists acting in the public interest, and the ability to contest national security search warrants being executed against them over what they publish and broadcast. The protest has sprung from media coverage of the web of laws the government is introducing to keep watch on Australians in the name of national security, and on its attempts to keep secret anything that might be embarrassing. Back in June, federal police raided the Canberra home of News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst, and the next day, the ABC's Sydney headquarters, in relation to separate and unconnected news stories, each based on leaked defence information. Smethurst had reported almost a year earlier on plans to expand the remit of cyber spy agency, the Australian Signals Directorate, to allow it to target Australian citizens. The ABC had attracted security agencies' attention for a different series of stories run another full year before that. Those reports on television, radio and online by journalists Dan Oakes and Sam Clark had revealed that Australian Special Forces soldiers who fought in Afghanistan were facing allegations of war crimes, allegations that are now also being investigated. The police raids became a flashpoint for growing public concern about increasingly draconian national security laws and what media organisations argue is a creeping security state that's trampling on Australians' right to know what's being done in their name. Prime Minister Morrison dismissed the concerns, suggesting in the Australian Parliament last week that journalists were just seeking a free pass. But his own government has recently introduced that very system. In response to the outcry over the raids, the Attorney General Christian Porter issued a legal directive to law enforcement agencies that no journalist should be prosecuted without his express permission. While that may be a sign the public unease has begun to bite politically, it didn't satisfy the media. We don't believe politicians should be deciding who gets charged either. The media organisations and their supporters argue the protections should be legal, not political, and focused on the public interest, not the interests of parliamentarians eager to achieve re-election. A key watchdog on the security apparatus, Parliament's powerful bipartisan Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, has now been directed to investigate the impact of security laws on press freedom. That inquiry is underway. While it progresses towards a final report, News Corp and the ABC are demanding to know from the government and prosecutors whether 5 months on from the raids, it's still possible their journalists will face charges. And the concerns persist about the reach of security laws. 4 days after the papers published their protest front pages, launching a campaign that will run for a month, that same parliamentary committee handed down a separate report into proposed new security legislation on facial recognition and data matching. The legislation is designed to allow the government to gather and match up mass biometric data on Australians to make it easier to track people and charge them with crimes. But the committee, comprised of members from the major opposition and government parties, said no. It said the legislation was too far-reaching, breached civil liberties, and that the drafters should go back to their drawing board. So now it's not just the nation's media pushing back against what's being done in the name of national security, but members of the government itself. It's all a reminder that knowledge is power, and from the perspective of those whose job it is to inform, that's kind of the point. For Monocle in Canberra, this is Karen Middleton.
That's all in today's program. You can read and subscribe to our daily email bulletin at our website, monocle.com. I'm Ben Ryland. The Monocle Minute returns on Tuesday.